Right, so first off, thank you so much to the organisers for putting on this great presentation, well, this great conference, and being able to be part of it is brilliant. So today I'm speaking about the links between the responsibility to protect and refugee resettlement. And as James said, it's part of a special issue, thank you, that's currently under review. So before discussing the links between the two frameworks, it is necessary to define the parameters of today's presentation in terms of their relevant definitions. So first, as I think everybody here knows by now at least, R2P has its three pillars, so I won't go through them in detail, but obviously the first reaffirms the state's responsibilities towards their populations in terms of protection from mass atrocity, and pillars two and three deal with the international community's assistance or response to a state manifestly failing its pillar one responsibilities. So today's discussion will fall under pillars two and three, as I'm going to talk about refugee protection as a potential R2P response for protecting populations from mass atrocity. Second, the phrase refugee protection includes the 1951 Convention, its 1967 Protocol, which removed some technical limitations, and along with international customary law, namely non-refoulement, asylum, and finally resettlement. So it's important to define the term refugee first, before I move on, which is defined by the convention as someone who, quote, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, is outside the country of his nationality and is unable to, or owing to such fear, is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country. So, Syria is the case that I'm focusing on, and it's an R2P case because there is evidence of mass atrocity and the state is manifestly failing to protect its population, as it is the largest perpetrator of mass atrocity within the state. At the same time, the international community has not had an effective response to the Syrian crisis, as we know, due to the lack of consensus on the Security Council, and this is the key point, though, is that how broadly or narrowly R2P is interpreted will define how a state itself sees its R2P. So those states that do not yet see their R2P duty discharged in their current efforts to, quote, help protect Syrian populations from mass atrocity, end quote, may have to look at other ways to practice their R2P on their own. So this is important in terms of an R2P response, because helping to protect populations from mass atrocity is not the same thing as, quote, ending the mass atrocity. So this is where there's a disconnect in terms of what R2P entails obligation-wise and what may be its larger aspirations. And such issues are compounded by the reality that even the elites within a state's government have varied interpretations of what R2P means. And for example, just this last week, there were two MPs on Channel 4 News arguing over the Aleppo situation, and both referred to R2P as the right to protect. And one was advocating that this right to protect must be applied to the crisis in Aleppo, and that it indeed allows unilateral intervention in Syria, which is very much coming from what Jason talked about today. In terms of that. So regardless of such confusion around R2P within a state, there are some conclusions to be drawn in how the UK government interprets what R2P in practice means, as it continues to rhetorically support R2P while pointing to its generous financial assistance to the region. So if you go on any of the government webpages, anywhere there's a mention of R2P, that anything that follows is about the generous financial assistance to the region surrounding Syria. So this suggests that the UK feels it has discharged its R2P responsibility to what it sees as the fullest, or at least pragmatically. So considering the mass displacement of Syrians due to the mass atrocities in Syria, it is interesting that the UK has not explicitly made a link between R2P and refugee protection. And some liberal states appear more generous in terms of refugee protection, like Germany, which Jennifer Welsh has alluded to before, which, even though it's showing some pushback now, they've been seen as heroically practicing their R2P. But it's not clear whether this is due to a different interpretation of what R2P actually requires, or more about the domestic structure and values in the state, or a combination of both in terms of how the norm of R2P has been localized in a liberal state context, or like a Western state context. So, interestingly, there's been no real historical link to link R2P and refugee protection in the literature either. Both the ICISS and the WSOD versions of R2P treat refugees as threats to peace and less like those deserving of protection. The first real link between the two was in the Secretary General's report on implementing R2P in 2009, largely due to the efforts of UNHCR, the UN body dealing with protection of displaced populations. Recently, due to the refugee crisis, there has been a concerted effort to link these two frameworks in the academic literature. However, this remains at odds with state practice of R2P. The literature envisions both practical and conceptual links. So R2P is about mass atrocities and refugee protection is about persecution. And it's often persecution is linked to mass atrocities because they often involve persecution. And every case where a population is facing mass atrocity, they do meet, arguably, the refugee threshold of a well-founded fear of persecution for a convention reason. But this is not to say that every person or population with a well-founded fear of persecution was actually facing mass atrocity. This prima facie definition is reflected practically in UNHCR's manuals. And much of the recent literature focuses on the original intent of the drafters and entrepreneurs of R2P, with special attention to exhausting other peaceful and humanitarian means before resorting to coercive military interventions. And asylum is generally the focus, and there is a presumption that R2P is not to be limited to an in situ response. Another key point which suggests an interpretation of a potentially broader obligation than, I don't want to put a value judgment on it, but simply helping to protect populations from mass atrocity. So at the same time, states are avoiding asylum, making regional agreements, like the one with UK and Turkey, or EU and Turkey, aimed at containing refugees in the region. So the focus on financial assistance to the region and the shirking away from refugee protection suggests an understanding that R2P is an in-situ response as well as the foreign policy issue that we've been kind of talking about as a theme, and that it's separate from international refugee law. So, for example, the UK handling of R2P matters are dealt with by the FCO, and much of the focus on financial assistance and prevention of flight to Europe. So understanding the gap between actual state practice in the powerful liberal state context like the UK and the academic literature on the link between R2P and refugee protection can be boiled down to one question. I think, whether R2P applies once populations cross the international border out of the manifestly failing state. The literature presumes a link from evaluating the original intent of R2P. Again, while there was no real mention of refugees in either iteration of R2P, the ICISS and the WSOD, the 2009 Secretary General report does make an explicit connection between the two, again, largely due to the work of UNHCR. The UN Secretary General's report on implementing the R2P refers to the UNHCR making asylum applications as R2P in practice, as we know, and notes that refugees and IDPs are often the populations seeking protection from R2P crimes. However, the report is more an interpretation by the Secretary General than a state interpretation would be my thought. It's not clear that states envisioned a similar link or responsibility when they endorsed the WSOD. And this is compounded by the fact that civil society organizations, which many have talked about in the last 2 days and the importance of civil society organizations, and also the UNHCR and migration practitioners and advocates have actually not used R2P as leverage in their calls for states when they're responding to the Syrian refugee crisis to take refugees. So I'm going to be researching these issues further with fieldwork that's coming. I think that's a really important point because it's been confirmed by many of the speakers, the engagement with civil society organizations are integral to elevating R2P. But again, the calls for using R2P as a way to get states to take their share of refugees has not come about. And there was some discussion of MSF. In fact, they're vehemently against R2P. But that, again, is largely due to an association of the norm being conflated with the use of force. So those are some other interpretive issues that are in the way. Right, so I've chosen to focus on resettlement as opposed to asylum. Resettlement involves the selection and transfer of refugees from a state in which they have sought protection to a third state, which has agreed to facilitate their arrival and admit them as refugees with permanent resident status. It occurs only after an individual or a group has been determined to fit within the definition of refugee. And in answering the question of whether R2P applies outside the manifestly failing state, there are some potential arguments which I've put up here but don't have time to go through each one in detail. While offers of resettlement are far less common than the grant of asylum overall, there is some potential protection for populations fleeing mass atrocities. And I've got two that I'm kind of still trying to flesh out. One, claimants for asylum must make it to the jurisdiction of the state where they will claim asylum, which as we can see has been made difficult. So asylum is potentially not as effective to look at this point. And second, the use of resettlement allows a broader R2P response, which may be one alternative way to meet R2P responsibilities in difficult cases like Syria, where there's no consensus in the Security Council and the humanitarian crisis continues to worsen. This broader response considers populations that have fled mass atrocity across the border of this manifestly failing state, and this is because resettlement addresses the needs of the host states in terms of their protection responsibility towards their populations, which now include these refugees that have come from Syria. Importantly, though, this broader response depends upon whether R2P demands an end to the mass atrocity or is helping protect population, which permits a more subjective determination for determining whether R2P responsibilities have been met yet or not. So the previous slide listed some practical and conceptual reasons for how resettlement serves as a means of discharging R2P in the Syrian context. But there's a big question I have to wrestle with, which in terms of Pillar 2 assistance in preventing new mass atrocities, is how great does the risk have to be? And this is something that I was brought up yesterday during Gillian's panel. Because states endorsed the WSOD, which narrowed the trigger of R2P to mass atrocity. So there's a clear mandate to reject this wide latitude of ICISS. So there's a need to balance this narrow reading with where acts of violence may become mass atrocity, and at which point is there a need for prevention in terms of the R2P that was endorsed by states. So I can see a reason for Pillar 2 assistance via resettlement, thank you, in terms of preventing refoulement. Which is what we've talked about before, is returning populations to places where they face mass atrocity again. So it's an ongoing risk and not a diminished risk, despite having crossed the international border. But again, how many need to be refouled, and do the underlying reasons for their refoulement matter as well? So in terms of relating to R2P. So this brings me to the conclusion of today's presentation, and R2P and refugee protection are indeed linked, because all R2P populations, which are those fleeing mass atrocity in a manifestly failing state, who have crossed an international border, do meet the refugee definition. And providing them with protection will obviously help protect them from mass atrocity, as at least that particular mass atrocity, as required. But additionally, the intention to link R2P with asylum and non-refoulement under the umbrella of other peaceful means did exist during and following the drafting of R2P, at least among the drafters and entrepreneurs around R2P and within the UN. So there's enough evidence to rationalize a link between R2P and refugee protection. And as James alluded to as well, Jennifer Welsh yesterday mentioned that, I think it was James alluded to this first, was about this being a palliative and not so much a curative way to operate. So those populations unable to flee are still obviously unprotected in R2P terms, so it's used in conjunction with something else. But there's also a conceptual presumption that's a little bit troubling, that R2P responses are not to be limited by territory, which does not quite square with how many states are undertaking their particular R2P responses. And so indeed, regardless of the convincing nexus between R2P and refugee protection, many states are closing their borders in response to Syrians fleeing mass atrocity, and are unlikely to open them unless there's some state interest to do so. So this gap between state practice of the norm and how the drafters and scholars of R2P envision a link between the two frameworks will likely persist, because implementing R2P via refugee protection does not appear to resonate with states, who are the actual actors discharging R2P responses at the international level. So this reality, combined with the absence of relying on R2P as an advocacy tool on the part of civil society organizations, including UNHCR, requires further research, which is what I will continue to do. Thank you.